Welcome to Inclusive Career Conversations, the go-to podcast for HR leaders, talent acquisition specialists, and D&I champions. I'm your host, Zoe Hayden-Jones, and each episode, we'll dive deep with thought leaders and trailblazers, uncovering actionable insights that empower you to create a more inclusive environment for everyone. I'm so glad you're here. Let's do this. Welcome to another episode of Inclusive Career Conversations. It's fantastic to have you here. This week, we are heading back to our webinar that we did with a brilliant panel. It was called Transforming Workplaces for Neurodiverse Individuals. And it was so brilliant. I was keen to bring it back as a podcast ep because there were so many insightful moments and key takeaways that you can start to implement in your organization. We had Cheryl Thompson, who is a leadership coach. We had Oliver McNiven, who is the founder of New Divergent. And we had Andrew Ward, who is a cybersecurity thinker. And it was a really brilliant panel who each had different opinions, different insights, and different experiences, which I think is key to remember that we are all individuals, we are all unique. So if you're managing a team, if you work in HR, it's important that you listen to conversations like this because I learn a lot, and we hope to run many more of these panels, of these webinars. So I will keep you posted. If you'd like a free guide, which summarizes all of the points that were discussed, you can head to the show notes now and download that. It's absolutely free. And also there's a link to watch the recording on our YouTube channel. So that's it. Enjoy. And as always, reach out if you have any questions at all. So yeah, welcome everyone. It is brilliant to have this incredible panel here today. We're going to take about 45 minutes of your time. We scheduled it over lunch. So hopefully if you're really busy, you can have a little listen in and you'll find something of interest. So we've got a range of people that have signed up from different industries, from different areas, organizations. So I'm sure there'll be something in this for everyone. It's going to be an empowering and interesting conversation. So just to get started, my name is Zoe Hayden-Jones, director and founder of Jobs for Women and Jobs for Neurodiverse. I've also got two podcasts, Inclusive Career Conversations and Women Work Wellbeing. So we're all about having conversations to make actionable change, because the more we hear from people in these real life situations, the more we can actually make real changes. So I'm really excited to welcome our guests today. So our panel, we have Cheryl Thompson, leadership coach. We have Oliver McNiven, who's the founder of New Divergent, and Andrew Williams, who is a cybersecurity professional. Welcome, my amazing panelists.
Thank you.
And I think Andrew Ward.
Andrew Ward. Oh my gosh. Why? Well, I don't know where I've got Williams from. That's not a great start, is it? My apologies, Andrew. But it's like I've started doing on the podcast now. Well, I can't edit it live anyway. Andrew Ward, there you go. Welcome, Andrew Ward. So we're gonna dive right in. I'm gonna start with you, Cheryl. You've already been on my podcast, of which I've had incredible feedback from so many people saying, this is like no-brainer stuff. We just need to make the workplace. We need to know our employees and we need to support our staff. So talk to us about your background and your experiences.
So background, always been in management, always been in leadership, banking, financial services. That's the product, but always been around humans, and everything I do starts, end, middle, human experience. And I think if you're going to work with humans, you just need to understand them as individuals. So for me, neurodiversity makes total sense because we just need to understand the individual in front of us and how we meet in the middle. So I've dedicated a life, I would say, to doing that, both at work and at home and in my family and in my relationships and the guy on the street who just ends up chatting because I know his whole life story within 2 minutes. So everything I do is about just humans and bringing people together and understanding what makes them tick. And I'm nosy, so it really works for me. So now I'm a leadership coach and mentor. And I essentially help them learn how to do that for themselves, how to go back into their businesses and understand people and actually care about that individuality. So that's me.
How do they do that? How does someone just really understand?
Can I swear? I always have to. I think we've asked this on the last one. Am I okay to swear?
Yeah, I think you're okay to swear as long as it's not some crazy. I mean, I know you. So yeah, go for it.
Well, it could be, you know. Only because the reason how people care is by giving a shit. You know, actually caring beyond the end of their nose. But how do they find out about individuals? Bear in mind, I'm a coach, so my whole career is based around conversations and questions. Ask somebody and be able to communicate about that question. I have, and the other two, you know, Oliver and Andrew, I'm sure will have their opinion on this, and I think we'll be of the same ilk, but correct me if I'm wrong. I have no issue anybody asking me any type of question that might seem sensitive or awkward, as long as it's done with the right intentions. So if somebody wants to know something about me, I'm a feminist, for example, I'm quite a vocal feminist. Talk to me about something to do with women or men or, you know, gender. And it might be a difficult one, but I'll love it. I don't even care, you know, if we disagree, I don't care, but just have the right intention. But I think so many people are afraid to ask questions and then they silence themselves. And how do we ever learn and understand the other person if we're not willing to be a bit uncomfortable and go, is it okay if I learn more about you? And I might get this wrong. I put my foot in it, but please know that if I do, it's unintentional. I'm just trying to step closer to the human that you are. And maybe you want to step closer to the human that I am and we can understand each other better. That's it.
That's so interesting. And I do think there's almost like a fear element of knowing that it's okay to ask questions. I'll throw it out to the panel. Do we all feel the same about being open to having questions?
Yeah, 1,000%. I kind of echo what Cheryl says, is that I'm a big believer in the silent voice is the most dangerous voice, you know, in your head and also out in society. And something I've been starting to use right recently, and a lot of all know what this phrase is sunlight is the best disinfectant. So if you get your ideas out, if you get the thoughts out, then what will be okay will rise to the surface, I think. But also it helps everyone involved be better informed, understand everyone else's intentions, and, you know, breeds an area for people to actually potentially mess up, but learn. I'm all for learning. So,
yeah, absolutely. And then over to you, Oliver, can you talk to us about your experiences we've had off the pod, off the webinar chats, but just give us a little insight into your experiences. Oh, I think you've frozen. We might have lost Oliver for a minute. I'll throw it back. Are you there, Andrew? Can you hear? Okay. Yeah, let's go over to you then while we've got a frozen Oliver. I'm sure he'll be back soon. Talk to us about your experience. You work in cyber, which is obviously vast. I've just done a podcast on a woman in cyber, which was brilliant. Talk to us about your experiences, why you're here today, and what it's like working in cyber.
Okay, so a bit of background on me. So I'm an account director at a company called Observer Solutions, and I think I've been in cyber for probably about 10 years unofficially, but been in the professional realm for probably 15. So started off as a person who thought they knew everything about IT because I could build a PC, and then how wrong was I? Yeah, and then basically moved into the sales realm, convincing people to part their well-earned shekels to actually, you know, either get the latest Apple or the latest Windows and so on, you know, that level. But why did I go into cyber? Because generally I like how my brain likes to figure out how things work. Majority is people. I like to figure out how people work, let's face that. But people are not so easy to interface with, so I like to figure out how problems are. Again, I'm not technical. I know enough to be dangerous. I try to curb my ego. So if I do know something, you know, people know that sometimes I might say, this is wrong, this is right. And I'll do my best to say, look, I know you don't know, but this is what I believe is correct. And there's enough space to hopefully for all of us to learn. But why cyber? Because I like scaring people, but more interaction. You know, to the end of the day, right? We can't ignore what's going on. We can't ignore it, and it's a baseline fact of our life. Generally, IT and cyber is considered like the interchangeable utility. No one cares about it. It's just going to be there. Who gives, right? But it's very damaging, it's very crippling, and there are real people at the end of it. So it, you know, for example, the cyber leaders, and typically in the, an attitude in the industry is, if someone gets breached, you fell down, you're getting fired. You're going to fix it, but you're getting fired and you move on. So the mental health in cyber is terrible, right? From my perspective, anecdotally, of course, right? But also, I generally think that a lot of things could be prevented. A lot of things could be combated if we had better education. And that's could be said for anything, right? But whilst we are so fixated on these things and everything is available, we've got to understand that there is a shared responsibility. Everyone has a responsibility to protect their information, to protect their data, and protect their colleagues and everyone around them. And it's just making it more accessible. That's my reason, my goal for being in it. Of course, not going to lie, it earns you some money. You know, it's a fairly good profession to be in, let's face it, right? But at the same time, it's essential. So hey, that's it. Have I answered your question? I have a habit of going off tangents, so
no, that's fine. And as someone that identifies as dyslexic, can you talk to us about how that is in the world of cyber, or any experiences in your career, your early career, or now?
I think as a form of self-discovery, because I was diagnosed in the middle of GCSEs, and you can imagine that was interesting. Always considered bright, but always had elements of being stupid or misunderstood. Not because it was labelled or anything like that. It's just a case of, I just thought, why can't I figure this out? Someone gets this, and this is simple. Why can't this click? It just doesn't click for me, but I'll get to it in another way. And anyway, I was used to, I guess, self-edit or self-mute is the thing. So even I'm doing it right now and I'm presenting it right now, is I would, if you've asked me a question, I'll probably have 6 ways to answer it, and I'll try and answer them all at the same time at that moment in time. And it'll get frustrating for people paying attention to you. It'll get frustrating for me because I'll pick it up and realize it, right? Right now, this is crazy, right? I'm trying to answer you, and it's anyway. So that's a real word thing for me. But in terms of identifying it, that has been very recent. Just so you know, I am not a victim. I never have been, I never will be, right? Regardless of how I present, regardless of what ailments I have, it's, you know, everyone has their own issues, everyone has their own conditions, it is what it is, right? Could that be a trauma response? Maybe, I don't know, right? But something that I found is, just before COVID and during COVID especially, actually realizing that we all learn differently, and actually when you're left alone with your thoughts and probably with your loved ones, some things can manifest, and they can manifest in a very difficult way. For me, I you know, a lot of people around me never knew, because I was able to mask it. They never knew, and I never turned it into a thing, right? But especially when we had to learn how to teach our children through lockdown and stuff, and I identified that perhaps my eldest might have similar things to me, she learned in a similar way to me, it kind of made me think, well, maybe I should start talking about it, and maybe I should actually come clean. And I'm not even gonna lie, I'm gonna say it is, my wife didn't even know I had it until probably the middle of lockdown, because I presented very well. I just, because it's never been a thing, it's just been part of my life. It's a superpower that I have, and it is what it is, you know.
So, wow. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. And Cheryl and I have talked about the idea of masking on the podcast. And a diagnosis at GCSE stage, my brother was similar. So I can sort of relate on that level, where he felt like he'd just been left, you know, with no support whatsoever at the most stressful time of a young person's life. Oliver, you're similar, I guess. You had a diagnosis in around 2000. Can you talk to us about your experience?
Yeah, I was diagnosed when I was 7 years old. I hear about my childhood and think it's actually not so much of a surprise that I was diagnosed. I presented with quite neurodivergent behavioural traits. And actually looking back at my at memories, which are secondhand memories, I guess, because people tell me, it's hard to recognise that young person. And I think that's probably a sort of process of picking up the societal narrative of ableism and masking, as you say. You know, shortly after I was diagnosed, I was permanently excluded from mainstream education. homeschooled for a little bit and then sort of got through a lot of my education from that point relatively unscathed. And I say that knowing like how much trauma neurodivergent people experience through their education. And I think like my relatively unscathed is probably quite harsh for the neurotypical who is in an environment which is built for their needs, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's just a little bit about my education and diagnosis.
And thank you for sharing that. And we've talked about this before, the fact that you use the word excluded from mainstream school, like that must carry some trauma. Have you done work around that? Because I know you're now a coach, which I want to talk to you about.
It's funny because, well, it's not funny, but it's interesting. Because not really. I think I just sort of ploughed on through my education and tried to go to the best institution I could, get onto the best graduate scheme that I could, so on and so forth. The most I've done with regards to, I guess, therapy around that was I did a LinkedIn post and just said like, hey, this is what happens. And I said I did a LinkedIn post, but I wrote and then posted it in a public place. It wasn't so much for the sort of the LinkedIn hype, but I think the reality is that people love this stuff because there's lots of other people who go through similar circumstance. I'm these numbers that we have, statistics, they're reflective of the reality, right? Mm-hmm. It's not an isolated case. It's a common thing, unfortunately. And it's still difficult for young people today. Although there's, maybe a healthier narrative. I've spoken to quite a few people, and me and Andrew spoke yesterday. And I think, there's still a lot of work to do in the educational setting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think having conversations like this is so important. To your point earlier, Andrew, the fact that your partner didn't know, did you say, until COVID? And I know, Oliver, you were diagnosed at 7. Cheryl, you were diagnosed, was it last year? Do you think that this idea of masking, let's just delve into the workplace a little bit more. Are people masking to fit in? And can we talk about that?
Yeah, I do. But I don't know if it's as clear cut to say they mask because they are not neurotypical. I think it's masked because we have a habit, I think, of trying to fit a stereotype for what the workplace wants us to be. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a mutual issue, because I don't believe, because when you read a job description or you whatever, it is what it is. Everyone's looking for a unicorn and they don't exist. Well, maybe they do. Look, there we go. They exist now. Right. Right. But and sometimes we have this habit of, because we're social creatures, aren't we? We want to fit in as best we can, and we see things other people express, and we caricaturize it. Is that the right word? And then absorb that into our social being at work, and then we just become this other person. I mean, how many times you have it where people say, "Ah, the work me is this, and my work friend is this," and da da da. And I think we do that automatically just to fit in, but also. I do also think that there probably isn't enough space to express yourself outside of the company mission goal. Now, again, if we turn it back, it's not I don't believe, and I'm a big believer in being told I'm wrong or exploring it, is I don't believe it is the responsibility of the company or the profession to actually try to explore that with you, because in there, you've got something to do. You're here for a function, get on with it. But I also do believe that you shouldn't be afraid to just be yourself and be human and be vulnerable. Yeah. So, but not vulnerable in weakness. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm a toxic man. I need to be strong or grow. But yeah.
I think that's interesting, the use of the word space when you described it as having a space to be, because I know in some cultures it is toxic and there isn't, you don't, if you're not feeling included. So I'll throw it out to Oliver and Cheryl. If, how can companies make that? Yeah, Oliver, go for it. How can we make it more so?
Sorry, I saw you unmuting as well, Cheryl. I'm desperate to respond to this too. You know, I'll agree with a lot of what Andrew said, but I disagree with the company not having some responsibility in this. I think actually, for me, you know, there can be some environments which are so awful for neurodivergent and other marginalized identities. And actually, you know, a change in attitude and values at the top of an organization can really transform that quite quickly. You know, I think you can have lots of accessibility initiatives, and you can get reports on, you know, the state of inclusion in your organization. But some change in attitude can you know, have a far bigger impact, in my opinion. And that's where I think the responsibility is. I think, like, get that done first, and then, you know, see what comes of it. Maybe it'll come out in the rest of the conversation, but I'll leave it there because I'm sure Cheryl has something to say.
And just to jump, do you mean change of attitude from the top down? So it is that where you're coming from?
I do 100%. I think that it's not the response, for my opinion, it shouldn't be put on managers, you know, middle managers of an organization, because I'm not saying eventually it shouldn't be put on middle managers. I'm saying that how can the organization ask middle managers to try and, like, you know, work on a case by case basis with their employees if the senior leadership aren't bought into that? Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if it doesn't come from the senior leadership, like, nothing will change. I think it'll just go back to the status quo quite quickly. So yeah, initially from the top, and then you know, change will come from that. Like, there's more work to do, but step one, that's my opinion.
Awesome. Cheryl, any thoughts on that?
Yes. What a surprise. Weirdly, I mean, I agree with both of them. I agree with Andrew and Oliver in this, but I think it goes much further back. So whilst I believe Andrew's right in the sense that we've got a job to do, get your job done, because we're there for a reason. You're getting paid for a reason. So I think that's a fair exchange. Turn up, do a job, get paid, go home. But I also agree with Oliver that if we can create a space of safety and people to be, and Andrew did say that as well, you know, like, people shouldn't be afraid to who they need to be or who they are. But where I go with this is the reason why we've got, Oliver, it not coming from the top down, the reason why we've got people not feeling safe to be themselves at work is because we start indoctrinating people from childhood, and we go through school. So we raise children to fit in, to be community pack-led, to feel safe in numbers, even if we don't agree with that. You know, horrific things have been done in this world by just following the crowd. Mm-hmm. And so people get taught to stay small, compliant, put your hands up if you want to speak, ask for permission to go to the toilet. And then before you get into, you go through university, and then all of a sudden you're in a job and we've got the same things. It's the same system. So what we're talking about, in my opinion here, is not whether it should be top down from leaders to managers to employees, or whatever. It should be within our parenting. It should be within our communities. It should be in our schools. It should be in our politics. It should be in our leadership. It should be societally across the board, where we actually go, you're safe with me, even if you're the polar opposite. You can be vastly different to me, and I will defend your right to be that, even if what you are offends, hurts, whatever me. I will defend your right to be you. Obviously, you know, illegal things taking place, that's a sort of separate thing. But as long as, you know. But my point being, it's a societal problem. And it starts, as a manager, Oliver, when, you know, we were talking about, like, middle management and different things, at the very start of my management career, regardless of what the leadership were doing, I still met people where they were at. I didn't need anyone's permission to do that. And people used to queue to get on my team. They'd be like, is there a list so we can move on to Cheryl's team? Oh. And I was tough. Like, I I managed people and I managed expectations and I managed outcomes and deliverables. You didn't get an easy ride on my team. We were the best and we worked hard for it. We were honest, open, but I understood you. And it was a pretty, you know, like, if you give, I'll give. Let's meet in the middle. I mean, it always often, it worked that I gave and then they gave, if that's, you know, I gave first and then they gave. But meet people as humans, know what they're doing outside of work, know why they're here, and actually ultimately know that they're here because they're getting paid. That's my thing. Most people don't turn up for the love of what they do. I know I do, genuinely, but the vast majority don't. So pay them and understand them as human beings as they come along. And if I need the permission of a CEO, then I've got something wrong as a human. But just to sort of loop back on that, I think that's where my autistic weirdness comes in. Because I never needed to be approved by anyone. You know, I was that weird kid that could have played on her own. I always had friends, but if they all dropped off the face of the earth tomorrow, I'd have definitely noticed it, but then been like, ooh, what's that over there? And gone and found another interest. I didn't need anyone's approval. And I'm so grateful that I didn't know what it was, what made me like that, but I'm told it's my autism. Like I say, I only found out last year. Psychiatrists both said that's why, because I've always been massively independent. Don't care what anyone else is doing. Do good by humans.
That's so interesting. And I love that what you said, Cheryl, about that it starts, that it's a much bigger issue. And starting at school, like I've got kids at school and it's that just layering on, isn't it? So I love everything that you just said. So
we've been, by the way, just quickly, yeah. Parenting. It's not just a school problem, it's a parenting problem. We should all be leading our own children and leading ourselves in a way that role models the right behaviours so people can be free and be safe. And that's my last word.
And I think what really comes across, Cheryl, in the work that you do is this, no wonder people were queuing to be on your team, because when you've got, regardless of whether you were like pushing them and the team were the best, understanding them as a human, asking them, like you said on the podcast when we spoke, like ask them what they're doing, know about their life so that they feel safe and valued. So if we're going to drill down into like real sort of, I don't know if I'm going to use the word accommodations, what can organizations, for people listening now, to take action from this webinar, are there specific accommodations or adjustments that are beneficial for the workplace? How can organizations start to implement it to welcome people that might be masking, people that are struggling? What can they do? I'll throw it out to anyone that wants to answer. Yeah, Oliver, go for it.
I think it gives me an opportunity to respond, because I think that, you know, there are these people within organisations like Cheryl. I'm sure, like, as a neurodivergent leader, Andrew's the same. And in all the leadership that I do, you know, that we care, right? It's not hard for us because we get that people are individuals and this stuff is important. We can see the benefits of it for the individual and more widely in the organisation. But that's us, and you know, we're those people. I think the reason why I think it's really important from, and I really care about this point, it's the reason why I bring it in before I go on the accommodations. I think the reason why it really needs to be from the top is that for all the people that aren't like us, the people who don't find it easy like we do, because where's the influence? The influence is where the money is, right? How do you improve parenting? Where do people learn it from? Do they learn it from the school? Well, we know the educational system isn't great. So where do they learn it from? They learn it from a great workplace. How do they learn it if it's not part of their, like, you know, understanding? A workplace that really values this stuff, like as an organization. So that's that. In terms of accommodations, I think it's just so varied. You know, I can only speak for myself. There are general accommodations that are, that can be useful for autistic people or ADHDers. That's my neurotype. I guess, like, for me, I need things in black and white. I need them to be emailed to me in writing because my memory is shocking. I'm really good at what I do. You know, when I'm switched on, it's good, but I'll forget it after a conversation. So put an email for me.
Awesome. Anyone else want to chime in with adjustments?
Andrew, I'm happy to talk if you're okay with that. I didn't want to jump in. I find it's funny, isn't it, how, by the way, my dog's crying because someone's just knocked at the door. So I'm really sorry.
Old dog, welcome.
I'm trying to calm her down in a very gentle way. I think it's funny, isn't it, just how all humans are so different. So one of my things that I love about what I've now found out is part to do with my autism is I've got a ridiculously weird memory that I can remember what you were wearing, where you were at, where you were sat from decades ago. You know, like people still ring me up from companies and go, do you remember that meeting we had 8 years ago? And I'm like, yeah, you had purple on, you were sat, and I can see it. So so I've got like a really don't need things to be emailed. However, weirdly, I prefer everything to be emailed because it's just more clear and it's written down and it's got an audit trail. I'm a real audit geek. But I think something I said years ago when I was first in management, and I still stand by it now, and I call it a communication strategy. So when you and it's not new, but you go into a place and say me and Andrew are going to start working together, and we sit down and I'm like, tell me how you prefer to be communicated with, in what method, how frequently, am I going to like overkill if I'm messaging you all the time, do you want me to just have your hands off, what do you need from me? And I had a boss yonks back who said, I get so many emails. If you want something from me, don't email me. Write it on a post-it note and stick it on my desk. And that was brilliant for me because it showed me how to tap in to him as an individual. So whenever I work with people, I say, let's work out who we are and let's exchange that information. And then we work best with one another. And then you say, like, so if I was working with Oliver and he was like, Cheryl, my memory's terrible. You can think we've had the fullest, best conversation in the world, and you can think everything's working. Second you leave, I've nothing. You know, like, fair enough. Now I know how to adapt to that. So I think my answer will be really boring every time because it will be like, speak to the individual, learn the individual. And if you have, and again, because I could have teams of hundreds of people and I could remember all of them individually, I could remember what their children's names were, I could remember what schools they were going to, how old they were. But if you don't, if you're not a freak like I am, because that is freaky, just make notes, you know, like notes that won't get sort of, you know, read and stolen and, you know, like breaching someone's data or whatever, but just make notes about them and or just say to them, my memory's terrible. Tell me where we were at last week, or tell me what you need from me, or tell me what's best. Even if you have to have the same repeat conversation, but it's just talk to the individual. That's the adaptation I think we need to do as managers and leaders, communicate better and fuller.
I think that's brilliant advice. And obviously what you do, Cheryl, you go into organizations, because when I think back to my sort of corporate career, your manager is so important. And I can remember the best managers I had, but we're not all born managers, are we? So where do we start? Is it an education piece? If there's an organization listening that has no policies, I'll say, or nothing in place to support neurodivergent individuals, where do they start? Is it someone going in like Oliver and doing a talk? Is it starting there, and then which way are they going to go?
Is that to me or to anyone?
Anyone.
Because I'm always mindful that I can talk for England. So I always try and, you know, like Andrew was saying, he can answer five different things at once. I can talk forever. So
I'm happy to jump in. So like with regards to the organizational perspective, I think the organization needs to remember that this is a really challenging thing for neurodivergent individuals. You know, there's a lot of stigma associated with these neurotypes, unfortunately. And I think, yeah, just taking that, like, you know, very human approach that's been mentioned a few times is really important. But I think, you know, and I'll come back to the sort of like policy in a moment. But I think, like, actually, you know, making a note of them in a bit more of a formal way is quite important, so that when there's handovers between managers, or even just things are really, really busy, and you know, we forget things, it's a good source to reference for the employee and the employer. And I think, like, with regards to policy, the organization can decide whether it wants to be driven by compliance or going beyond compliance. So like, you know, it's quite easy to understand what compliance is in this space. You know, any decent HR department will understand that, and it's sort of building around that. But then it's whether an organization wants to say, like, actually, there's maybe an organizational benefit, like, you know, there's good business in being inclusive of our 20% of employees. And being inclusive of that 20% of employees is going beyond compliance. So it's, you know, I think, like you say, getting the people in to do the talks and understanding, you know, what that looks like, because it will be dependent on the organization, the size of the organization, what the organization do, so on and so forth.
Awesome. Anyone else want to say anything on that?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't really have a lot to add really to what Cheryl and Oliver have said, but I think the thing for me in terms of how to bring it in, manage it and regulate it, it's just become more human. It's just an addition to what they've both said already. Just be more human. But I mean by, and you can be strategic with it. So zero in on the people that are the loudest, get them on board. Right. And try and understand their motivations. Try and find the cultural actors as well within the business, depending on the size of the business, of course. But make it so that, okay, if there are people within this business that are influential, let's lean on them. Let's figure out, as Cheryl would say, let's try and understand how that person ticks, see whether they are able to create an even more, inclusive environment around the people that they're influencing. And it's not just the way of, right, make it inclusive. You can't do that. It doesn't work. But almost get it so that people are able to speak to them and have different people. And maybe they're sub-managers, or maybe that is a true people management. Who knows, right? Maybe not by title. But what I mean is get people to talk, people to confide into other people where they see some similarity in. And then again, to Oliver's point, this is very challenging. This isn't something for someone just to go out and say, "Hey, boy, it's me. I've got the." You can't. That doesn't happen unless they are. I guess that they've been socialized or they've been diagnosed very early on to almost apologize for who they are, to say, "By the way, this is me. Just letting you know." And if you couldn't tell already, this is me. So, but then I guess empowering those persons to try and spot it within the team and try to say, look, hey, look, it's not difficult. It is, but it's not difficult to speak out. It's not difficult to confide. And I don't know. I don't really know where I'm going now anyway. I think I've lost my point, but yeah. Sorry. This
no, I love
this
it.
Another aspect. It's what happens.
Yeah. Cheryl, can I jump
in? Yeah, yeah, that's okay. So again, we're very like agreeable, aren't we? I agree with what everyone said. And I think another aspect to what both Andrew and Oliver have said is approaching this with non-judgment. Because I think if we go into things making a decision about what, when X person does Y, it means this, is a really dangerous approach. And having this open-minded curiosity about somebody without damning them ahead of it. So the amount of times that I've worked with people where they've made a decision on behalf of somebody and diagnosed them behind the scenes without having this conversation, or not diagnosed them and denigrated them. You're like, oh God, have you heard how... I remember once someone, because of their monotone voice, they had no intonation in their voice and they were quite straightforward, plain speaking. And they were criticized for that. They were brilliant at their job. They were like this gifted mind at their job. And then they turn up to meetings and they wouldn't be all, you know, like this. And I was like, I remember speaking, and these were senior people, not, you know, these were like very senior people, not entry level into their job. And I remember having a conversation with them. Why does this conversation matter? Why does it matter whether their voice goes up and down, you know, or whether they open their arms when they speak? You know, what have you decided about that individual based upon these things? Now, actually, it turned out the person was autistic. Then I've got another example of where somebody made loads of typos in their emails, between into sort of team emails. a project manager. They were very busy. They were probably one of the best project managers I've ever worked with. Like, shit, not good. And I remember the MD coming over to me and going, that's embarrassing. They need to sort out their typos. I went, did you understand what they said? Yeah, but that's not the point. Did it get done? Did the outcome get achieved? Yeah, but that's not the point. Well, what is your point then? Because your point might be that you're a really judgmental, need to have a word with yourself, human. You know, that, and don't get me wrong, I know like if things are, you know, you can't understand or whatever, then that's a different conversation, but we got things done. The job got done. And I think sometimes we need to just wind a few things back and actually ask ourselves, what's the point of this judgment that we've got? And I've been doing, like I say, I got diagnosed last year. I've been having these conversations that we're talking about today for decades in my career, asking people to wind this back a bit and have a look in the mirror. And what is it you're trying to achieve here? No wonder people don't speak. No wonder people don't share who they are, because they've been judged before they've even got to the table. And that, again, is for me the societal problem that we've got, that we're making these, whatever word you want to call it, conditions, diagnoses, you know, whatever is the right or wrong word, we're making it a problem where actually all of our differences are, I think, amazing. And does the job get done? Yes or no? It's as easy as that. And I even had someone this morning contact me saying that they've been bullied at work, and they were talking about their inability to articulate themselves in a certain way. And this person didn't tell me they had a diagnosis. And as I was thinking, I thought, they haven't mentioned it, so I'm not going to mention it. But the way they were talking to me, there were some potential things that I would have thought about that they may have. But it's not for me to jump in and do that, and I'll treat them as they come to me. But I almost think this person's now been performance managed and been bullied because they don't show up the same way as the boss shows up. I think when you've got this echo chamber attitude and this ego attitude that all the people that work on my team need to turn up and be mini versions of me, you've failed, mate. You need to go back to management training. And that's my big sort of, you know, do the work on yourself, be open-minded, be non-judgmental, be curious, be kind, be compassionate, understand that we're all different, and actually understand that that's how this world's a better place. And that's my adaptation. Do the work.
Can I jump in very quickly and just say that, like, bullying's the right way to describe the behavior, the way Cheryl described it there. It's it can be bullying, and you know, it's for people to realize that, you know, when they're managing, like, you can call it a performance improvement plan when they're managing and doing what they're doing. Think, are they managing like benign behaviors? Because quite often they are managing benign behaviors. And the reality is when you label these benign behaviors as deficits, when you label them as negative, like, no wonder that person becomes ill, right? If we like label someone as less, as broken, as wrong in whatever way, like, no wonder they get ill, right? It's like this self-fulfilling reality. And I think the thing I'd say, because I didn't mention it and I don't think we've mentioned it, but like, if businesses can reasonably expect that a person is in you know, protected under the Disability Act, they don't need to have an official diagnosis. Like, that person is protected by the Disability Act, right? Like, the business has a responsibility to reasonably adjust the workplace reasonably. And that is dependent on the business size, but yeah, it's important. And the businesses can be punished for not doing that.
Yeah, well said, Oliver. I'm glad you brought that up. And I know we've got to wrap up soon, but what to Cheryl's point, which I think you really, really brought to life, and I think anyone listening will really resonate to the examples in the typo in the email. If we're thinking about the hiring process, when we think about sometimes you've got to jump through hoops and, you know, do a whole circus performance, whatever you've got to do, like, you have to have a degree and then you have to do, you know, I spoke to someone on the podcast who has dyscalculia, maths dyslexia, and was asked on the spot to do a maths equation. Like, hello, do we need to do on the spot math equations? How can companies then, based on what we've talked about, not lose this incredible talent that is at their fingertips because of their interview processes because of their rigid structure. What I need any lasting comments, final comments rather, on that. I'll throw it out to the panel.
I think play to the strengths of what you require on your team. So, but know that, I mean, I kind of said it earlier on, like sometimes there's some job applications which will be asking for a flipping unicorn, which is impossible to find, right? And you think, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've either spoken to someone who's trying to go for a job, or even I've looked at something and I'm like, I could do that job, but literally 10 out of the 12 things, no idea. But I know I'll do this really well. I know I'll be great. Just get me into an interview. I'm going to do it. It's going to happen, right? But yeah, and I think with that is potentially you may only potentially, and it comes down to finances, you may only have enough for one employee maybe. But is there a way to try and split that role into maybe two or three if you can, if possible, right? And find a way to finance for three hires, right? But then say, and do start getting a bit judgmental, because then you go, right, this person's really good at this, and now we have to find this to be covered. Or you just review what you've already got. Like, what do we actually need? Why do we need it? What is important? And is it trainable? Can you actually help that person get to where you might need them to be to cover off some of their weaknesses? Because no one's perfect at everything. So identify the strengths, play to them, but then say, okay, can we actually work with the weaknesses and help them through it? Have they got an aptitude to learn? As long as we get them in front and say, look, we understand that actually this is your strength, but what do you think about it? What do you feel? Is this something you are able to work on? This is what you've got to analyze and have them analyze. And does the business even flip and need it? That's me anyway. That's it. Yeah.
Thank you. Anyone else want to jump in?
And I was just going to talk about what Andrew said about the almost like the barriers to employment, which I think shouldn't exist. And I think everybody has a right to be employed, from somebody who's currently homeless to, you know, somebody who's come from prison, or, you know, because actually there's a lot of hidden disability within those demographics, you know, prison, homelessness, you know, and we know why, because Oliver even talked himself about having to be homeschooled. Imagine he didn't have a family that could and would do that. So we lose a lot of people along the way because of these hidden disabilities, is what they're called. But I think we also lose people. And this is again why, when I was in, you know, certainly within management and leadership, and I've done this within my coaching, where I review processes for people. And are you putting barriers in front of people being employed? And are you making things more difficult? So I think often what you can do is ask the person how they would turn up as their best version of themselves. So if, for example, an interview is really difficult, or a CV, some people haven't got the, like, writing a CV, it's the most boring, and who does that? Send a video instead. You know, like if somebody might feel better going, look, I'm going to do a verbal CV for you, and I'm going to talk you through, and I'll send it you on Loom, and I feel more comfortable that way. And if you send me the questions you need to know about my career experience, do that, and I'll just answer them. So what were you doing 5 years ago? Blah, 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 blah. How did that benefit the company? Blah, 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 blah. What did you find difficult about it? Blah, 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 blah. You just do that. Why do we have to stick to what we've always done? Because that's what our ancestors told us. Let's start ripping up the rule book and just bringing different people in and going, tell me what works best for you. Because I might say, actually, a written, you know, I'd rather write it. And Oliver might say something else. And Andrew might say performative dance, you know, but find out who we are. And then yeah, I could see, I knew you'd be performative dance.
You know very well. I've actually got one or two people at university watching this, and they know that I used to love dancing. They, you know me. That's it.
I know you, babes. I know you.
Here we go. I'll jump in and just say, for this, my answer is inspired by Nancy Doyle. Don't know if anyone's familiar with Nancy Doyle, but Nancy says, you know, and many other people say this, right? But it's the way it was described. We have a specialized skill set, right? Like, here are the traits. Like, we're great at some things, we're really crap at other things, right? So it's a spiky profile, right? We don't have a generalist skill set. We could be really good at numerical reasoning, verbal reasoning, and, you know, not very good at abstract reasoning. You know, like, abstract things just don't make sense to us in any way, shape, or form. And where am I going with this? Well, I'm going where Nancy Doyle went with this, which is interview for what you need. It's pretty much what Andrew said, I think, in Andrew's answer. But like, why are you asking someone to do a presentation if presenting is not part of that role?
Yeah.
What are you getting out of that, right? If the next job in the hierarchy requires presentation, fair enough. That makes sense. If it's a people-facing role that is in sales, yep, makes sense. Not in a job which requires, you know, writing paragraphs for publication, right? Doesn't make sense. Ask them to write a few paragraphs for publication. Then you get people who can do the job. And neurodivergent people can do those jobs, right? And you know, I agree with Cheryl also. It's like, you know, ask the individual, in what way can they show up best? In what way can they present their skills to give the best version of themselves to the recruiters? Everybody wins. Everybody wins. It's like a good thing.
Yeah, they need to wake up to that. I think there was some golden nuggets in there. It's not difficult. I think it's like Cheryl said, we need to just rip up the rule book. Why have we got all these rules? Thank you. We have gone a little bit over, but I wanted to because I think there's such a barrier when it comes to recruitment. There's amazing people, and you know, as we've talked about, they're not feeling comfortable to speak up. I spoke to someone who, again, on the podcast, who was sort of ghosted at stage 10 of an interview process when she mentioned her disability. So it's happening and it's real. So we need it to stop. Thank you to my amazing panel, Andrew Ward, Cheryl Thompson, Oliver McNiven. I'm grateful for your time, your expertise, and I'll make sure that I send out a link so people can connect with you. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
I'm just going to say, typical of the neurodivergent webinar to go over time. Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I could do this all day. I really could do this all day.
Let's do it.
I was going to say, I could be on for hours talking about this because there's so much more we could have said as well. I'm like,
we could do like a monthly theme. Everyone can bring their lunch and coffee. Let's do it. I'm so grateful to all of you. Have a wonderful day. And thanks for joining us. If you joined us live, take care and we'll see you soon.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.